You know, as I've been reading through the material that Philip put together, and we have several books that are left. The others bought several books, so still have about five or six books. If you would like to have a book and you don't have a book, just talk to me and we'll be sure that you get a book so you can follow along with us and spend some time thinking about these things. As I was saying, a lot of what Philip says in his discussion about lifelong zeal is really, really personal. And one of the things that you'll notice as we go through this lesson is he kind of has a checklist of those things that we need to think about as we go through step one of our effort to maintain lifelong zeal, finding our starting point. And most of those things are things that only we know about ourselves. And so we're not going to go through those as if they were questions, and I'll put you on the spot and say, okay, Kim, tell me what your answer to this question or this point was. That's not the way we're going to use this. Those are things that you can use at home and you can go through and you can actually score yourself. Look at the score sheet that he gives and kind of put that together. And then over here, he finally says, if you score between 0 and 25, you're zealous for evil. I don't think anybody's going to fall there. If you're 25 to 50, you're lukewarm. 50 to 75, and then 75 to 99, you're zealous for God. So actually do this exercise. Yeah.
I had a couple different people, and I think the first time I looked at it, when you just look at the question, it sort of sometimes seems thin and narrow. But as I got to think about it and got another person to talk about it, instead of giving themselves a 3 or a 0 because I knew what they were doing and they didn't remember what they were doing, the scoring had made them feel very unworthy.
Inadequate.
And so what I'm suggesting to everybody is that when you feel like you really fell down on that, talk to somebody that you know and see if maybe you just have forgotten that you sent money to the Philippines or you're always there when somebody's in the hospital or, you know, because it doesn't necessarily weight it, send your eye to everything that a Christian can have zeal in.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I've said that a lot of times about Matthew 24. When Jesus presents the picture of the judgment and he turns to those that were going to be destined to join him in heaven, and he says, I was sick, you visited me, I was in prison, you came to me, I did all of these, you have done all of these things. And they have this, I think, a normal human response. They said, when did we do that? We've never done anything, but we never saw you in prison and came and visited you. And he said, inasmuch as you did it to the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. Sometimes we undervalue the things that we do because in reality, they don't impress us as being something that a real zealot would do, somebody that was really on fire for the Lord. And those things, even though they seem small and insignificant, they really are significant. Yeah.
And it's not, quite often we know it's not us that really we're doing it. It's the goodness that we've gotten from God and seeing the goodness. So we don't credit ourselves with that because we know that it's God that has done that for us. So,
Oh, absolutely.
yeah.
Absolutely. And that's really no different than what Paul said when he, remember when he was going to Jerusalem to talk about the question of circumcision? Those folks had come from Jerusalem and they were troubling the church. there in Antioch, and they said to Paul and some others, we want you to go to Jerusalem and find out whether they were really sent to do this. And the record says when he got to Jerusalem, he rehearsed all of the things that the Lord was doing through him. And so I think Paul probably looked at his life and thought, well, you know, I really haven't done anything. And we look at it and think, this is a man that's on fire for God. Yeah, Bill.
Looking at myself, I think when we're younger, whether Christian or otherwise, we tend to want to think of all the good things we did to get a higher score to pass the test. And it was as I've gotten older, I've become more self-critical.
That's probably true.
And as Carol said, I can't imagine getting anything but a low score. If I tell the truth, well, maybe I'm too critical.
Yeah, that is absolutely possible. Yeah, Lee.
I felt the same way when I first read this and analyzed it. And I'm thinking, I feel inadequate with the way it's written. And then I'm thinking, well, no, wait a minute. I did such and such. Well, no, maybe you don't get credit for that. Well, maybe I do. So I had to rethink it several times before I put my score down.
Yeah. And it's, you know, Philip is not putting this in here so that we'll feel bad about ourselves. He's just giving us some guidelines so that we can honestly look at ourselves. When I was preaching in Alaska, there was a fellow that came there. He was from, I believe it was Nigeria, and I don't remember exactly where he was from or what his name was, and I apologize for that. He came there. He was asking the church in Anchorage to help to support him as a preacher in Nigeria. And he came to Anchorage one Sunday. It was cold. It was like 20 below or something like that. And he was amazed. He said, here it is, 20 degrees below zero, and it didn't make any difference. You guys still got together for worship, just like it was a regular old day. And I thought, you know, you're right. And that, so I asked him, I said, well, tell me about what worship is like in the summer for you. And he said, well, it's about 120 degrees or something like that, 110 degrees. And a lot of us walk between 3 and 4 miles, and we get to a building, and it's just a tin roof and doesn't have any sides on it, no windows, no air conditioning, of course. And we do that, and we come together, and we stay together for a longer period of time because we all walk to get there. And I thought, and you're thinking that me getting in my car, driving to a building that's heated and air conditioned and has all of the amenities, and I have every coat in the world so I can stay warm, you're thinking that I'm doing something special when I think that you're the one that's doing something special. And that made a big impression on me. You know, sometimes we think, well, I haven't really helped anybody because all I did was take them a sandwich. They were, you know, Ron was in the hospital and Leslie was there, and she's going to stay there all day. She's not going to leave. She's not even going to go down to the cafe and get a sandwich. So you go to the cafe and you pick up a sandwich and you bring it to Leslie while she's in the family waiting room, and you think, well, I haven't really done anything special. But you have.
You did.
You've done something that needed to be done, and it was important. So don't discount what you've done. Yeah, Bill.
One time, Larry and I were hiking together, and I asked him, I said, there's a place in the New Testament that says someone calls Jesus good teacher. And Jesus said, why do you call me good? No one is good save God. And I asked, how can I be sanctified if I'm not good? How can I be righteous if I'm not good? Because I'm not God. And he explained it to me. And I still have trouble feeling I'm sanctified or I'm righteous. We, if we're honest, we judge ourselves against the scriptures rather than against other people. But it's hard to conceive that.
Yeah, it is. And I say all of this, and I also want to give deference to a point that Kim has often made, that we don't really take our Christianity as seriously sometimes as we should. You know, it needs to be something that consumes us. Every decision that we make taking God into account and how this decision we're making right now is going to impact what we do. And, you know, now, frankly, that can lead to paralysis. We had an opportunity to buy a house when I was preaching in Anchorage. And I thought, you know, here I am, I'm contemplating buying this house. If I buy this house, it's going to really stretch my budget. And that means I won't have money to do some of the things that I would like to do to help people. And so maybe it's Satan that's putting this house out there in front of me as a temptation to get me to focus on something other than God. And Kim was able to see a much larger picture. And she said, you know, us buying this house can be a blessing. And it turned out to be that way. In the 16 years that we lived in Alaska, somebody lived with us over half the time. And we had the space where we could take people in and they could do that. And that was a wonderful blessing. But it can, you know, when you start thinking about God as a part of every decision that you make, it can paralyze you. And you start wondering whether you're making the right decision or not. You know, should I move? And I don't have to go back to Alaska. I mean, I had left the ministry and I was doing something else. I was working for the state of Oregon and the church here wanted me to come and preach. And Kim said, you know, maybe that's God's way of saying he wants you to go back into the ministry. I don't know. Sometimes it comes down to, when you start making these decisions, sometimes it comes down to what Esther's uncle Mordecai said to her. You know, there was this plot to kill all of the Jews. Mordecai, of course, knows that she's a Jew, but nobody else does. She's in a position of being the queen. And he says, you need to talk to King Xerxes and make sure that this doesn't happen. And Esther, to paraphrase freely, Esther said, you know, I don't just take it upon myself to go talk to the king. I have to wait until he calls me. And if I say something and he doesn't approve and he drops his scepter, it's off with my head. And Mordecai says, who knows? Maybe you were put in the kingdom for just a time like this. And if it's not you, and Xerxes lowers his scepter and you get your head lopped off, then God will find a different way to accomplish his task. But you act like you know. And that goes a long way. The Apostle Paul said the same thing to Philemon when he was talking about his escaped slave, Onesimus. Onesimus had run away from Philemon. And of course, he went to Rome, because if you were a slave and you ran away, you wanted to go to some place where you could blend in and you wouldn't be found out. So he goes to Rome, has the misfortune of running into his old owner's best friend, Paul. And Paul tells him, go back home. Okay. Paul writes a letter to Philemon, and he says, who knows? That's the important thing. Who knows? Maybe he ran away so that I could convert him and send him back to you. Not just as a slave, but now I send him back as a brother. And sometimes we're going to get to the point in our decision making where we say, who knows? But I'm going to act like God wants me to do this, and I'll do it to the very best of my ability. And if it turns out that that wasn't God's plan, God will find some other way to work out his plan. Yeah, Bill.
Thinking about your situation with the house and other situations that we might first see it as a temptation. But if it's a big thing you need to think about instead of just rejecting it, if you see that, you might just be able to turn that around into the exact opposite thing.
That's also true. You know, God or Satan could have meant it as a temptation. And Kim and I said, no, it's not going to be a temptation. We're going to use it.
And he thought of it as a stumbling block and used it as a stepping stone.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Exactly right. So as you consider this checklist that Phil gives you, take all of these things into account and be brutally honest with yourself. You know, you look at the questions that he asks. Let's just take one, for example. I put God's glory ahead of personal preferences, reputation, or safety. And you look at that and say, do I really do that? That takes some reflection to know whether that's what you're really doing. And, you know, some of us have been in positions professionally where speaking up, saying something, might have a negative effect on our professional life. I was in that position when I was working for the state. You know, there are some things as a state employee you're just not allowed to say. And am I willing to run the risk of being fired because I talked to somebody about the gospel? So I always kept a Bible on my desk. It was usually open, so everybody that came in my office knew I had a Bible. They knew I had a Bible anyway because they knew my resume. They knew that I had been a minister. I didn't downplay that, but you know, I wasn't obnoxious about it. Those are difficult questions. If you're in a position, like Kim was in a position in HR, you know, there were a lot of times when you almost bite your tongue because something has happened and you want to say, well, the reason this happened is because you were doing what you were doing, that's why it happened. And you can't be quite as brutally honest as you'd like to be. Yeah.
Well, you think about safety, and I can think of just say three things on hand. I've heard of different situations where somebody with a gun might be standing up front and says, well, if you're a Christian, will you stand up or will you go forward? And you know, when you get to a certain age and you don't have any other people, you're going, well, better me than somebody else. And you say, well, in that situation, which is highly unlikely to happen, I think I would step forward. But I think of the farm women during the Depression, who when somebody come knock on the back door, if they had enough to feed them a sandwich or whatever, and I have a screen door with the glass on the front, and I'm pretty hesitant to open my door to anybody. But on the other hand, if I'm driving down the road and the bicycle falls or whatever, most likely I'm willing to run the risk that there might be somebody there and stop and help. So it's not a one answer for safety. Then I heard somebody say here the other day, in light of Charlie being assassinated, that said that you can't kill a Christian, you just send them on to their reward. And I thought, well, that's good from a certain perspective, but not from when you're in the mourning situation. But
I think we have to, like Jesus said, be as harmless as doves and be as wise as serpents. Be as wise as wolves. Don't be unwise, but at the same time, don't let your desire for safety paralyze you so that you don't do good. And it can easily do that. And I, especially for women, you know, I think women have a harder time with this than men do.
How so? What do you mean?
Well,
with safety, you mean?
I'm sorry?
With safety?
With a safety issue.
Oh, okay.
Just because you're more easily overpowered and some things like
that. I understand.
You know,
because my head was going somewhere else, and I can kind of share some. I've probably not shared this with you people, but you know, in my career as a human resources director for public agencies, I had the last city that I worked for, I had to write the sanctuary city policy, something that I firmly was against, and I had to write that policy for our city and for our city council, because our city council, I was a staff member and that was my assignment. So those are difficult things. I had to, and then years and years before that, I had to rewrite all of the personnel rules and regulations to include transgender, homosexuality, you know, all of it. And that was my job and I had to do it. And how, as a Christian, Do you manage that? And those were really tough, real life situations that we're put into. So some of these scenarios, like Carol was saying, or some of these outlandish scenarios that people kind of dream up, and is very, like you said, very unlikely they're going to happen. But as Christians, especially in the workplace, if you have positions of authority and of any kind of influence, you are often tasked with doing some things that are very, very difficult to try to balance and manage as a Christian. I did have a city manager one time tell me, and I might have told this story because this has really stuck with me over the years, and I took it as a great compliment, and I don't mean to say that I'm tooting my horn or anything like that, but one time we were at an executive staff meeting after the night before, we had a very, very long, contentious a city council meeting, and the next morning we're in the executive staff meeting, and they started kind of trying to figure out ways to sort of skirt around issues and try to get this taken care of and all that. And all of a sudden I was like, okay, wait a minute. I said, let's just stop. I said, you know what? There's a right and a wrong. And what we're doing is we've convoluted this to the point that we're willing to break the law and do something wrong to placate one of our city council members. And I said, we need to stop this. We need to look at the law and do it the right way. There are right ways to do this. And afterwards, she called me into her office. The city manager did, and I was a little bit nervous. I thought, okay, I'm out the door now. And she said, you know what? I appreciate that. She said, you are the conscience of our organization. And I appreciated that, and that kind of bolstered me so I could say that in the future. And I could say, you know what, there's a right way and a wrong way. And let's not go too far down this path. Let's stick on the right path. So these are kind of real life. And I love these questions because they're general enough that you can kind of, like you said, kind of struggle with them and go back and forth and really have to think about them.
Yeah.
A bit. It's just a guide to think about.
Yeah. I've been in weird situations. At one time, I was a fundraiser for a political party, and we were having this big shindig, and political parties being what they are, they bought all kinds of booze. And the chairman of the political party came into my office and said, "We're going to store all the booze in your office." And I thought, why are you going to store it in my office?
There.
Yeah. Because you're the only person I can think of that can be around all that booze and not steal it. And I thought, well, okay, I guess that's kind of a vote of confidence.
Backhanded compliment.
Yeah, I'm not real sure.
You could have poured half of the bottles out and filled them.
My dad was an accountant and was privy to all of the financial workings of a major builder in Southern California. And they came to him one time, they were considering some things, and they came to him and they said, "We're going to confide in you because we know you're the only person in this entire organization who will not repeat it." And that goes a long way. You're when I have to find somebody I can trust, I know I can trust you. And that says a lot. You know, I think sometimes we have more impact on the people around us than we think we have. And I know that was true when I was with the political party, because I thought I could restore some sense of decorum or some sense of doing what's right in this setting. And turns out I couldn't. But
politicians.
Politicians. And I thought maybe I had more of an impact than I initially thought. So let's go about having all of the impact that we can. And goodness knows, I'm not going to be the guy who can do all kinds of things that are just amazing. When I die, there's not going to be a major rally at a sports arena and hundreds of thousands of people are going to show up and extol my virtues. I will probably die and 5 or 6 people will show up and they'll put me in the ground.
Adios.
Goodbye. And good riddance. But I think it's important to work through some of these things and to think about what God really expects. And he makes the point. Lukewarm Christians believe religion is a good and important thing to have in life, but they think it shouldn't really consume you. And we don't want to be perceived as religious fanatics. We do want to be perceived as religious people, but we don't want to be fanatics. And that's kind of a lukewarm position, isn't it? When you get right down to it, that's kind of a lukewarm position. Lukewarm Christians have good intentions to participate in good deeds someday, but they just can't seem to find the time to do it. Yeah, Bill.
In Ecclesiastes, Solomon said, be not overly religious. Can you put a perspective on that that
yeah.
doesn't make us lukewarm?
Yeah, I think so. He's saying it in the in a context that ultimately gave rise to people that were called the bruised and bleeding Pharisees. Okay? They never wanted to look at a woman and lust after that woman. And so they walked around with their eyes closed all the time. And you can imagine why they were called the bruised and bleeding Pharisees. Just, you know, like me, I got that band-aid on my forehead. I had my eyes open when I did this, by the way. It wasn't. They kept their eyes closed, and they were always tripping over things and falling down. And so they're always bruised. They're always bleeding. I think that's an over.
It was like this morning's sermon. The whitewashed tombs was this morning's sermon.
Don't spend all of your time trying to make sure that somebody else doesn't fall into sin. Look at yourself. And I think there is the possibility that we become overly religious. I would not have chosen that phraseology.
But God did.
God did. And he makes it difficult for me to deal with it because God chose that terminology. But that terminology, I think, is reflective of an environment that produced bruised and bleeding Pharisees. Or Pharisees that didn't want to ever touch a woman, and so they carried around a handkerchief. And if they had to help a woman who had fallen down and help pick her up, they would put the handkerchief over their hand so that they didn't touch the woman and they could help her up. Well, I think that's ridiculous. Yeah.
But I wonder if overly religious is not necessarily the way that it's more tongue-in-cheek. In other words, the person is pushing their religion, pushing the fact that they are religious over and above somebody else. It's more of an attitude, a snootiness, I'm better because of you. It's not that your religion is all-consuming. It's that you're using your religion as a prestige. Sort of like when you talked about Simon when the sorcerer. And I thought when he said, give me those powers, I didn't think about it the way you said that he wanted to do trick and trade people again. I looked at it and thought he wanted the power. I mean, he wanted to be in the same position as the apostles, and he wanted to elevate himself back up to that situation, not a servant's heart. And that's sort of the same sort of feeling,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, the description of Simon before he became a Christian is that everybody listened to him. Everybody gave him a position because he was basically deceiving them with magic tricks. And they listened to him.
They paid him.
Yeah.
He could make a lot of money.
Yeah. That's a good point. We don't ever want to use Christianity and even our practice of Christianity to look down on someone else. Yeah, Bill.
Scriptures tell us we're supposed to be in the world, but not of the world. So we don't have to separate ourselves from all other human beings that aren't of our faith. But there's also something I remember from that a preacher said several years ago, and I've always remembered it, that we, for our psychological welfare, we need a certain amount of skin contact with other human beings. And that doesn't mean anything extreme, but I'm not exactly sure how to, you know, if that hugs from brothers and sisters or anything more, but that we don't separate ourselves from other people. If somebody needs a hand up, male, female, child, or elder, we should help them up.
Yeah.
You know, and that helping is good for our welfare.
Yeah.
But it's not something that we do every day.
Well, I think it should be. We should be attuned to the people that are around us that need help. There are often opportunities that go unnoticed, and I'm the worst to say, I go through life fat, dumb, and happy. And I dismiss opportunities to help other people because, honestly, I just don't see it. And I need to, if there is a weakness in my preparation, I just need to be more attuned to what's happening in the people around me. And some people have that ability to just connect immediately. And Dean is one of them. He connects with people so quickly. And I just don't, I don't, I've not cultivated that in my life. And I think I need to. Kim does that. You know, Eileen does that. Just, you're around Eileen for 5 minutes and you think she's your best friend. That's just the way she is. And that's the way she practices her Christianity and makes it very real. Yeah, Dean.
Well, I was thinking, and you see examples throughout the world, but I grew up in a house where you didn't pass anybody on the side of the road. My dad helped everybody. We skipped the day of fishing and towed a boat from so far out in the ocean you couldn't see the shore, so that he wouldn't get fined by the Coast Guard for not having proper equipment. My father-in-law, who was a Christian, opposite ends of the scale, he bought this pickup, and the first thing he did was put a winch on the front of his truck. And I asked him what he needed that winch for. And he said, well, did you know that people charge anywhere from $50 to $200 to pull somebody out of the ditch? He got the biggest kick on his road trips out of just pulling people out of the ditch and then driving down the road. You know, he made conscious decisions in his life to be prepared to help people. You know, and Carol says that there's a lot of scary things out there, but what we used to carry jumper cables, remember those days? Well, now the computers on cars, you'll fry your own computer. But you can go to Costco for $69 and buy a jump box, always have that in your car, and you can help somebody. And you don't have to give them a long, lengthy speech about how awesome you are as a person or as a Christian. Pete Smart's boy used to work for me, and he used to get so mad because we didn't pass anybody that was broke down in an intersection. And I'd make him get his big behind out of the truck and help me push people. And it frustrated him. It made me so angry that we would take time out of our day. But if we just honestly are always looking, the opportunities are there.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes we're in a hurry and sometimes we're distracted. Sometimes we're the only person in a car or we have our children in the car, so we make different decisions. But opportunities surround us. And it's really easy to just be in the habit of not seeing them. And I'm not picking on you by any means, because I know how much work you do as an individual and as a preacher. But we can kind of go through life with blinders on and not see, you know, not hear the mother in the grocery store telling her child, you know, we can't get that, even though it's something that they need because we don't have enough money. Not a beggar, but someone who's in need that you just hear the need. I don't think it has to be just our brothers and sisters. I think, you know, true and undefiled religion, you know, all the way back in the Old Testament, God wanted us to love our brothers and sisters. Well, he created everybody.
Yeah.
He's our father. Everybody's my brother. Everybody's my sister in some instance. So I have these responsibilities in my life to open my eyes and see the needs. And obviously one person can't meet every need. But, you know, we read a book here called The Tipping Point. Small acts cause big change.
That's a good point. We prepare ourselves to be able to help. I used to carry a $20 bill in my wallet all the time, just so that I would have something to give to somebody who needed help. And I've gotten away from doing that, and now if you ever find cash in my wallet, something strange happened, because I don't carry cash anymore, you know. I think there's something to be said for intentionally putting ourselves in the position where we can help and we're able to help, so that when the need arises, we can see it and we can help, just like that.
You know, and like him, you don't ever want to sound like you're tooting your own horn, but in the Cottage Grove community, I watch the Cottage Grove webpage and I see things, and I'll help kids with school supplies, or I'll help an individual with this or with that. I give by, and I do all that stuff on my own. 99% of the time, my wife doesn't even know that I've done it. But I posted an ad for an employee, and I listed some requirements. And as social media gets, people got nasty and made their comments. And what was refreshing to me was, I don't even know the names of these people that I help, but people were coming on and saying, that guy or that business does so much for the community or for kids of the community. So you're making more of an impact than you think by doing small things. I mean, $40 worth of school supplies isn't a lot, but it's a lot if you don't have $40. And so there's so many opportunities out there that aren't just handing $5 out the window to a guy holding a cardboard sign that's made a choice to be on a corner with a cardboard sign. It's helping people that are truly in need, and then opening doors. So, and I think that just each time you do that, it sparks that zeal.
Yeah.
Right? So you see the positive that comes out of it one way or the other, or you just feel the warm feeling, and that sparks a greater zeal to do greater things or to do more things or to the best of your ability. So
yeah,
for me anyway, that's the way I kind of look at it.
And
I just wanted to say there are ladies, and they know who they are, and even some of the men in here that have helped me so much over the last 5 years by their notes, by their phone calls, everything. And I think that's wonderful, because I've been in places where that doesn't happen.
Yeah, and I not to brag on Ann and Cal, but when Kim rolled a van over 1,000 miles away from Anchorage, Cal found out that we didn't have a way to get Mandy and Jenny back home because they were in the medical district, and Kim. But I mean, Kim's medical distress was her ear was cut off. Mandy, on the other hand, was in serious shape, and Cal and Ann drove over 1,000 miles to come and get us, and then drove us back home. And every bump that Cal hit on a rock road, on a gravel road, Mandy screamed from the back seat. So, you know, there are people that just go out of their way to do what they can do. And if I hadn't mentioned that, nobody would know. Yeah.
Well, just to start off with, your $20 probably doesn't help anybody unless they're hungry now anymore. So if you revive that, you have to put in a 10 and two 20s to see how you go with that. But this morning I was listening to one of our songs, and it correlated with your sermon, send in the light, or standing in the light, standing in the light. And I thought about your sermon, and people don't say I'm standing in the darkness. And that was your sermon, the combination. They don't see I'm standing in the darkness.
Yeah.
It feels so good to stand in the light.
Yeah. And, you know, to kind of pick up what Dean said, we have a responsibility, not just to Christians, but to the strangers and the foreigners. And remember, that's where God told Israel. Take care of the stranger and foreigner. Remember, you were one time a stranger and a foreigner in the land of Egypt. So you take care of strangers and foreigners that are among you. Not just your brother. Sometimes it's harder to take care of the stranger than it is your brother. Sometimes it's harder to take care of the brother than it is the stranger. But we need to be in a position to help, and we need to put ourselves in the position that we can help. That's why Paul made the statement that he made, let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him work with his hands that he may have to give to him that hath need. Okay? So work hard. Not to provide for yourself necessarily, although that's one of the things that will happen. Work hard so that you'll have to give to people that have need. Yeah, and
stick to check yourselves a year from now and see how your score changed.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Thank you for making it. That's a really good point. Write these things down and keep track. And Phil, one of the things that he suggests is pick out that area where you see that you're weak and decide that you're really going to work on that. And there's a lot to be said for that. He says lukewarm Christians are often silent about their faith. And I really believe that we need to be much more careful about speaking to other people about our faith. You know, our example is not going to be enough. We're going to have to tell people why we do what we do. Amen. We're going to be prepared to do that. I have said for many, many years, there are a lot of people who have no relationship with God who do things that look like the things that Christians do, and they do it for an entirely different purpose. My example has always been Robert Kennedy. He wanted to be president in the worst possible way, so he didn't divorce his wife, because a divorced man couldn't be elected president. Now it's not true anymore, but back then, that was true. And if you saw him stay faithful to his wife, you would have said, looks like a Christian. No, he wanted to be president. That's why he did it. Yeah, Bill, you got the last comment. We're out of time.
There was a businessman in Cottage Grove a few years ago. Very successful. He spent over $1 million to build a replica of an old air racer. And the way he conducted business, the way he treated people, his personal mannerisms, his language, amazingly today. You would have sworn he was a man of God from the tip of his toes to the top of his head. He crashed that plane and gave up his life to save some people that he would have hit if he tried to land. And at his funeral, I asked, I believe his wife, was Jim a Christian? No, he wasn't. But in every way, to me, he appeared to be one.
So we're going to have to speak up. We're going to have to be willing to, in a sense, put ourselves out there and say, yeah, somebody says, oh, thank you so much. It's a perfect opportunity for us to interject into that conversation. Yeah, you know, the reason I do that is because Jesus wants me to. And we have to be honest about it. Okay. We've run out of time. It's been a good discussion of the different things that Philip has suggested. And so take the time. Actually work through this list. And I think Anne had a really good suggestion. Write down your scores.